Thank you very much, Bill. Senator Hart, distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen. I think what Bill intended to say was any labor leader who can read a book without moving his lips is classified as an intellectual. I'm afraid that much of what I may say this noon will fall under the heading of cliches, but our nation does continue in a grave social crisis. It's my personal belief that the lack of riotous conduct in the various sectors of our country should not deceive us as to not only the continuance, but the worsening of the problems. We still have inflation. We still have inflation with massive unemployment now after several months. And we still have inflation with one-fourth of our productive capacity lying idle. We have a huge federal deficit. And the pumping in to the money supply, which I am convinced will take place later in this year for political purposes, will renew an inflationary surge without regard to labor costs. It was Milton Friedman, who said that trade unions were as strong in the United States in 1961 to 64, when there was no inflation, as in 1965-69, when there was inflation. Prices in the United States more than doubled in the Civil War, when unions were almost non-existent, in World War I, when unions were weak, and in World War II, when unions were strong. Inflation, he says, is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And the wage price control policy, this administration, is more a cost-cutting program than it is a program against inflation. It is designed to redistribute the national income more into profit channels with lower living standards for the working class. And the tax program, of course, we have opposed as being designed for the same purpose. Investment incentive credit, to which we had sharp opposition, as being futile in its aims and being a tax giveaway in its reality, was agreed to by the then chief executive officer of the General Motors Corporation when he said last August that most companies of any size determine their purchases of equipment by the needs of the business and not by any short-term tax advantages. We, of course, oppose DISC, and we certainly oppose the legalization of still further liberalization in the depreciation rules changes. Now, given the swollen size of the federal budget, given our disastrously growing unmet social needs, and given the unwillingness of the Congress and the administration to tackle the largest component of that budget, military spending, there are obviously going to have to be, in the not too distant future, new taxes. The huge waste in the military budget does not relate necessarily to weapons systems or new weapons systems, but to the fact that that bureaucracy, unchecked, unchallenged, almost unaccountable over a period of many years, has inevitably developed gross and wasteful practices. I think Deputy Secretary Packard, when he left, drawing attention to our domestic bases, which can't be closed because of being built into the political infrastructure of various congressional areas, and the fact that Portugal was given up to $435 million in economic and social development credits in return for air and naval bases in the Azores and through 1974. And this is why we get trial balloons for the value-added tax, which, of course, as a tax, has a wonderful advantage. You don't see it. You just pay it. And this on top of the growing maldistribution of our incomes, reversing some progress painfully made over a generation. And the figures released by Joseph Peschman of the American Finance Association, which show that the lowest 20% of our nation's people get 3.2% of the nation's income, whereas the top 20% get 45.8%, and the top 1% get 6.8%, or the top 1% get more than twice as much as all of the 20% at the bottom of the heap. And with such statistics getting worse, It will take more than law and order campaigns to curb crime and social disorder. Let me say just a few things about the question of profits. President Nixon last October, speaking in my home city of Detroit, said, in answer to a question, "The more profits, the more jobs." Well, now obviously this is not necessarily true. Certainly given our kind of economic system, an enterprise has to be profitable to give jobs. But the simple statement, "the more profits, the more jobs," isn't true. Had it been true, then we would never have had the Great Depression of the 1930s, because prices were sliding gently down through the latter half of the 1920s. There were no labor unions of any consequence. Government intervention and interference in the business system was practically non-existent. But more and more of the rewards of productivity were going into profit margins and higher incomes, with the inevitable correction brought through the Great Depression. It was the first National City Bank newsletter for last August 1971 that said virtually all of the 22% decline in manufacturing earnings during the recession has been made up during the first two quarters of the recovery. That is through last June. Now we take profits after taxes as a percentage of gross corporate product. And for the 25 years, 46 through 70, the average was 10.5%. In the first 6 months of 1971, it was only 6.7%. But of course, profits are calculated after depreciation charges. And there has been an increasing liberalization of tax depreciation schedules down through the years since World War II. Capital consumption allowances, the statistical term for depreciation, rose from $4.7 billion in 1946 to an annual rate of $63 billion in the first half of 1971. Now, in 25 years, there has not been a 13 times increase in the real use of capital. And if we take cash flow, which is the more meaningful statistic, if we take profits plus capital consumption allowances as a ratio of gross corporate product, we find the percentage for the 25 years ending with 1970 averaged 18.3%. In the first half of 1971, on an annual basis, it was 17.7%, almost with that depressed a rate of the economy at the 25-year average for all of the years after World War II. If we take productivity that we hear so much about, productivity reflected in unit labor costs. In the first half of the decade of the 1960s, the position of United States manufacturers improved relative to all of their major industrial competitors except Japan, because U.S. unit labor costs were virtually stable in those 5 years. As a matter of fact, had a net decline of 0.7%. In the second 5 years of the decade, however, U.S. unit labor costs went up by almost 4%. Productivity was cut in half. But it was nothing that suddenly changed. The mini recession of 1966, the engineered recession of 1969-1971, is the answer to why we have had that drop in productivity and that increase in part in unit labor costs. Now, we have a government which is not responsive to the people's needs. We in UIW believe we need new faces in the Congress and new ways in the Congress of doing things. And congressional secrecy is an enemy of the people. In 1966, Congress passed the Freedom of Information Act, providing access by the public, including the press, to the decision-making processes of the executive branch. It was a major victory for the democratic process. But in Congress itself, secrecy still reigns supreme. To be sure, the final decisions are made on the floor of both houses, are amply recorded, and are open to public view. The recording of televotes in the House of Representatives adopted last year, more than 130 years after the House of Commons took the same step, was an important step in the right direction. Such a teller's vote now, of course, can be obtained by 20 members demanding it. There is a move now underway in the Democratic caucus to increase that from 20 to 40 or 50. Historically, democratically elected legislative bodies have justified secrecy as a protection against reprisals from a powerful sovereign. In our country, such reprisals cannot occur. No member of Congress need fear the loss of his personal freedom by action of a president. Apparently, the members do fear loss of their seats at the hands of the electorate because the use of secrecy in the Congress, except in rare cases involving the national security, can be justified only as protection against the public's right to know. We have a representative government, and that government can be truly representative only if the voters know how their representatives behave. Within the party caucus, key decisions are secretly made which can and do directly affect the quality of legislation. The election of Joe Wagner over Don Fraser will have a lasting impact on the decisions of the most powerful committee in the Congress, Ways and Means. The choice of party floor leader and the House Speaker have a similar impact. And everyone knows that the decisions made on the floor are only the tip of the iceberg. The basic shaping of legislation is done behind closed doors in committee markup sessions. The House Appropriations Subcommittees even hear testimony behind closed doors. All meetings of committees should be open to the public. The Ways and Means and Finance Committees have special rules which tend to keep their sessions secret even from committee members. The absence of subcommittees and the prohibition against personal staff members attending executive sessions means that only staff responsive to the chairman and the ranking minority member can be fully informed and have a meaningful impact on the legislation. A committee member absent because of pressing business elsewhere is left in the dark. The issue of seniority itself would recede in importance if the processes of election of committee chairmen were open to public view and recorded votes. By the time such elections reach the floor, all the major decisions relating to chairmanships have already been made. If, however, the votes of the various committee on committees were recorded, and votes in the caucuses recorded, a challenge to a John McMillan could be made meaningful. The political parties in Congress should no longer be allowed to claim that such matters are internal and thus justify shielding them from public view. They are substantive matters. We have no party responsibility in our national legislature. Unlike the parliamentary governments of Europe, where party discipline can be enforced and the party goes to the public on its record as a single entity, we have, as a practical matter, 535 parties in the Congress, and each party member disciplines himself. If this system is to work effectively, if it is to make our non-responsive government responsive to the people, we must open the full record of each member to the discipline of the people. We must destroy the last vestiges of secrecy in the Congress. And coupled with this, I believe most strongly, we need a new occupant of the White House. I am personally concerned as to the Democratic nominee, and I want to underscore that it is not quite true, as Bill Eaton reflected news stories, that I proposed to the executive board of the UIW some 2 weeks ago that we endorse Ed Muskie, and I got my ears knocked off. What that executive board decided was based upon a recommendation made by me. We are not going to at this time make a national organizational endorsement, but the UIW may in various places make, if its local leaders and rank and file so determine, make state or local organizational endorsements, as we have done in the state of Ohio. For George McGovern, I have the highest regard. He is a man of great integrity, of great courage, and programmatically is most close to the political position of UIW. Hubert Humphrey has been a strong friend of the UIW down through the years. In 1968, rather than him suffering a so-called disastrous defeat, I share the opinion that he waged a magnificent campaign under most difficult circumstances, and going into a campaign 16 points behind and losing it only by a whisker was a tribute indeed to his tenacity, vigor, and campaigning skill. If either George McGovern or Hubert Humphrey were the nominee of the Democratic Party, I, as a Democrat and an American, could enthusiastically support such a candidacy. I have a decided personal preference, however, for Senator Edmund Muskie for President of the United States. I believe we need to unite behind a leader who can defeat Richard Nixon in November. I favor Senator Muskie not only because I believe he is the strongest Democratic candidate, but because I believe he is our best choice for president in 1972. Ed Muskie was twice elected governor in an overwhelmingly Republican state. As governor, he fought and won the struggle for long overdue social changes ranging from prison reform to a vast expansion of educational opportunity. There was only a shadow of a Democratic Party in Maine before he started. Today, that party continues its progressive leadership of the state of Maine. And Ed Muskie has given that kind of leadership in the Senate, too. He was the first senator to respond to the environmental crisis. He led the fight for model cities in 1966 and has sponsored all of the major housing legislation of the last decade. He is a champion of equal rights and of fairness and equity in the economy and our society. I saw him in the campaign of 1968 reaching across our deep divisions to those who were ready to give up on the system. And I saw him on election eve in 1970, a voice of reason and decency appealing to our best traditions. I see him now leading us to victory over the politics of fear.
Mr. Woodcock, in your statement, you personally endorse Senator Muskie. I have two questions which bear on that. Number one, has the UAW decided which presidential candidate it will support? And number two, why couldn't you convince your fellow UAW officers to endorse Senator Muskie?
Taking number two first, I did not try, therefore I did not fail. It was the feeling of the discussion that we had on the board that there are various areas of the country in which the primaries should find their own natural level. There's nothing wrong with competition. If there's no bloodletting as between the contenders, the competition can in fact be helpful in clarifying the issues and bringing more forcefully the candidates to the attention of the electorate. Now, in the state of Ohio, where we have a very substantial portion of our membership, and we are the biggest union in that state, our three directors there, fully supported by unanimous decision of our Community Action Program Board, some 44 members, have endorsed in the Ohio primary Senator Muskie. I am quite sure that the UAW people up in the state of Minnesota will go as they always have gone over the years with Senator Hubert Humphrey. In the state of Iowa, where the process began the other night and where Muskie got 36%, as I remember it, and uncommitted 36%, and the rest scattered with George McGovern getting the bulk of the balance, many key UAW leaders were strongly in that state in support of Ed Muskie, although there was no organizational endorsement. And we feel that since we have a convention at the end of April, by that time, it may be that we will want to make a national organizational endorsement through our elected delegates, but certainly none will be made on a national basis until that time.
As president of the UAW, would you have difficulties in supporting a candidate for U.S. president who favors busing when necessary for school integration? And number two, do you regard busing as essential to the progress of school desegregation?
Well, this is obviously a highly emotional issue, and it's being subtly exploited by men in high places whose mission should be to pull the country together and not pull it apart. It is particularly an explosive issue in the heartland of the UAW and the Detroit-Pontiac areas of Michigan, because it is strongly to the fore. I have said, speaking individually, that given our pattern of segregated housing, given a worsening of that pattern of segregated housing, it may be that busing as a tool if the courts so decide, and across school district and county lines is a necessary support if we really believe what we must believe, and that is an integrated education. It brings with it, however, having said that, tremendous problems, and it lays bare the fact that we have in our educational system deliberately ignored the worsening of educational possibilities in some schools as long as they were peopled only by minorities. We were not concerned about it, and busing is a problem because we have neglected those facilities, we have neglected those schools, we have not given them the police protection, we have not given them the educational input, and our sins of neglect are now being laid at the doorstep of all of us. And I would pray to God that men who seek the high office of president would realize that one seeks to become president of the United States to heal the nation's wounds, to pull this country together, and not simply to seek the office by whatever means, exacerbating whatever hates, passions there may be in the country.
How much support will George Wallace have in blue-collar ranks this year? And what can and what will be done to overcome it? Sounds like a loaded question to me.
Well, one of the things that struck me in 1968, when George Wallace, of course, was gaining wide support, particularly among blue-collar ranks and white blue-collar workers, I was involved part of the summer of 1968 in an organizing campaign in St. Louis in a big plant where, very frankly, we were trying to raid another union. And we were the most liberal choice of the three on the ballot. And workers would come in, and on one side they'd have a big UAW button, and on the other side they'd have a big Wallace button, which didn't quite reconcile itself in my mind. And as I began to talk to them, they were for Wallace not necessarily on a racist business, although that came into it to some degree, but mostly because Wallace represented to them something against the establishment. He was one man who was talking about their problems. And I was also amazed to find how many of them it had been for Bob Kennedy before he had been killed a short time before that. And one of the things that was able to be exploited at that time was the fact that white blue-collar workers who have tremendous economic problems were being portrayed as stupid, as clods, as having it made economically, all having swimming pools in the backyard. And they resented this, and they were believing that blacks and Puerto Ricans and Chicanos were being taken care of, which of course wasn't true, but they believed it was true. But nobody was doing anything about their problems, and it was this responsive chord that Wallace struck. Now, obviously, busing is an issue that he can exploit very, very well in key spots. It's my personal belief that as compared to 1968, Wallace does not have the popular support that he had then. And I think that we showed in the state of Michigan that we were able to handle this problem. At one point in the polls, Wallace had almost 20% support. And we pulled that down to under 10% by the time the election was held. And of course, we carried Michigan by 220,000 votes for Humphrey over Nixon at a time when all the states surrounding were going into the Nixon column by varying majorities. And it was because we were responsive and spoke directly to the needs and the worries and the concerns of our members. And I think we can do that again.
Will there ever be a Labor Party in the United States? What are the factors that will or will not produce such a party?
No, I don't think there'll ever be a Labor Party in the United States. Politically, I began my life long, long ago as a young man, as a socialist, a social democrat, call it what you will. At that time, the labor movement held little hope. When the CIO came along, that filled my feelings about an organization that could worry and concern and fight for the solution of the problems of the people. The creation of a Labor Party would be foreign to the development of the American tradition. It would be a divisive factor. It would not do anything except cut off the more liberal Democrats, particularly in the northern states. And for that reason, I am quite sure the labor movement in this country will never try and develop a class party on a political basis. And of course, when you look at Europe, the Labor Party in Britain is a labor party only in the sense they have that anachronistic procedure whereby the trade unions go into the party conference and vote a block of all the members of the party who have paid the political per capita tax, which is not a very good system. The Social Democratic Party in Germany, of course, has moved more and more to a broad mass support party that more and more plays down the straight and narrow Marxist approach to the solution of things. And I think the Democratic Party in this country is fully capable of developing as the instrument of the people, as it has in critical times in the past. I think in the southern states, the Democratic Party, within the next very few years, will be a vibrant political instrument that will speak well for the people in those southern states. And it's my personal belief, further, that our race problem will be settled first in the southern states of the United States, because there, at least, there is a recognition of each other as human beings and not as legal entities as we tend to retreat in the North. And I think that all of these things put together, the Democratic Party will be a truly national party, a truly liberal party, and fill every need that a Labor Party under the most ideal circumstances could possibly fill.
I have a series of questions now on more or less union matters. First one is, do you get along with George Meany better than Walter Reuther did?
Well, this is an inevitable question, I suppose, although, strangely enough, and now getting on for 2 years, I haven't been asked it in quite this personal a term. There were differences of opinion inside the AFL-CIO, and the various positions taken by Walter Reuther as president were not individual decisions. They were talked through with the leadership of the union. And obviously, when strong personalities have differences of opinion, and certainly Reuther was a strong personality, George Meany is a strong personality, it creates personal animosities which surface and sometimes seem to take over from what was really the beginning of the problem. I was not associated in a personal sense with those differences. I had no personal association with Mr. Meany in the arguing about them. And I have had excellent cooperation from Mr. Meany when I went to him on joining our forces on the health security program. I found a ready response. We have worked closely together on that. On the General Motors strike, the AFL-CIO gave us full support. And so because circumstances are different, I have enjoyed on a personal basis a good association with Mr. Meany.
What are the prospects for the UAW re-entering the AFL-CIO?
Well, I have a very simple answer for that. We can't afford it. Reference was made to our financial difficulties. We have two kinds of financial difficulties. We had the strike fund difficulties, where the fund, of course, was bankrupted by the more than $150 million we spent in support of the GM strike. And on the operational side of our finances, those difficulties were in the main created by much greater than expected capital expenditures for our Family Education Center facility at Black Lake, which finally cost us $23 million. We are paying down that deficit, and so very frankly, I mean it when I say we can't afford it, which is also one reason why the ALA is being phased out. It's not because the program didn't work. It's not because we are not getting along with Brotherhood of Teamsters. We are very well, but because we had to stop paying that per capita tax last April and are in no position to resume it, And since the money that was on hand last April, with no continuing input, is now pretty well spent out, there is no point to keeping a paper organization alive. Let me say finally that we would not go back, having taken such a major step as disaffiliation, we would not go back without the sanction of a convention of our union. We have such a convention coming up in April. We will not be considering this question at that time, so that in any event, the decision on this matter is at least 2 years away.
What was your reaction to the Hoffa parole?
Well, the Hoffa commutation of sentence, I had expressed my beliefs, and I know that members of our board agree with this, that the last time that Jimmy Hoffa was up for parole, I think if his name had not been Jimmy Hoffa, it's my personal belief he would have been paroled at that time. I felt that the time he had spent justified the parole, and very frankly, among others, before Christmas, asked the President of the United States if he would either consider clemency or a commutation of sentence, and when in fact it happened, I said that as far as I was concerned, justice in this particular had been served. And I might add, has nothing to do with the fact we owe the Teamsters $25 million.
I have a series of questions now on the pay board. How is the pay board doing? How is it handling its responsibilities?
Having said they were incredibly incompetent, it's a little difficult to answer that question. I might say, too, that except for appearing as a plaintiff before the board on the aerospace cases, yesterday was the first time I'd been back to serve as a member of the board since the 8th of November. Given the freeze, and it's quite obvious that you couldn't go through 90 days of freeze and then just back to the unchecked market system, although I think we should as quickly as possible, get back to the market system. It takes no great giant to figure out, if you assume the national productivity as a long-term trend rate of 3%, and you're shooting for an inflation rate of between 2 and 3%, and you assume, which is an incredibly wrong assumption, that all of the inflation is due to labor cost push, but then okay, you'll allow 5.5% as the goal. I was as angry as I was over aerospace because we were given commitments that if aerospace tracked auto, that they would be approvable on a tandem basis, and we could show that tracking had been true of past collective bargaining, and of course that commitment was not kept. We still intend to pursue that matter in the courts, and I think the handling of decisions by the board has been quixotic, and I hope they settle down. I hope that they can end some of the period of confusion, because unless we get greater certainty on the possibility of making decisions against what may be anticipated, then the national economy is going to continue to be in considerable trouble. The fact, of course, is that inflationary pressures are due to a lot of other things than labor cost push. This inflation began with the escalation of the war in Vietnam in 65 by the lack of courage in the Johnson administration making the necessary tax demands of the Congress in 1966. And labor cost push did not become a part of the problem until well into 1967. It is simply a part of the problem, and if the other parts of the problem are not pursued with equal vigor, then we're going to have a new surge of inflation before this year is out.
Should Judge Bolt be confirmed?
Well, we didn't offer any testimony with regard to it. I have no personal feelings against Judge Bold. He's a very sincere man. He's a very decent man. And he admits he doesn't know anything about the field. Sometimes there are those who say, well, maybe that's an advantage. I want to say this, however, with regard to the public members, it is a fact that the administration did try to get, as public members of that pay board, most of the knowledgeable, competent people in the labor relations field. And they practically universally turned them down. For what reason, I don't know. I've asked some of them, I don't wish to identify them by name, why they didn't accept, because obviously a knowledgeable chairman would have been much better for the past period. If commitments were not to be kept, then commitments should not be made. A knowledgeable chairman would have prevented that. But commitments having once been made, honorable commitments, then they should have been kept, and a knowledgeable chairman would have seen that that did happen. But I'm perfectly content at this juncture to have the judge continue as the chairman, and to hope his days will be numbered, because I hope the days of the board are numbered.
I'm informed in this question that Washington lawyers are being invited to a seminar on phase two next month at a fee of $65. If it costs $65 to teach lawyers about phase two, does that mean the whole thing is so complicated that it's a flop?
Well, it's certainly confusing. I thought when you said about the $65, you know, a few weeks ago, I got an invitation. This was an employer's group interested in fighting inflation, of course, asking would I come down to the Bahamas with an honorarium, and I could stay for the whole week if I wanted, at their expense, and all of them were paying, I think it was $1,500 as an attendance fee, so they could learn how to restrain the inflationary pressures in the American wage economy.
Apparently, there's quite a bit of interest in the General Motors Vega plant at Lordstown in Ohio. And apparently, the questioners are pretty confused as to what in the heck is going on there. Can you tell us exactly what did take place?
Yes, I think I can, and I wish I didn't have to. First of all, some of the news stories that the problem is because the workforce is young, and, you know, we have this new generation rebellion. That's just not consistent with the facts. The workforce is young. Average age is 24. But what's happened in Lordstown is also happening in various degrees in St. Louis. Not now in Norwood, because that plant is shut down for a changeover, and in Willow Run, Michigan. These are all assembly plants. The assembly plant system in General Motors used to be largely Chevrolet and Fisher Body occupying the same facilities, Fisher making the bodies, Chevrolet assembling the cars. And then they began after the war to establish what they call Buick Oldsmobile Pontiac assembly plants, BOP assembly plants. But then as the pressures of an antitrust suit moved up and down, General Motors began to lose Chevrolet in the system. So that if, in fact, there ever was a major antitrust suit that would think seriously about spinning off Chevrolet, they wouldn't be able to find Chevrolet. It would be so intermingled in the system. So they began to move BOP to a General Motors assembly division. And those plants, instead of assembling just Buicks, Olds, Pontiacs, also assembled Chevrolets. The Lordstown plant was a Chevrolet-Fisher combination until last October. Had been from the day it was opened in 1966. The Fisher Body Division General Motors is not a monolith. Its various divisions develop their own policies. And the General Motors, the Fisher Body Division is a relatively decent division, has decent employee relations. Chevrolet is sort of in the middle of the spectrum. Last October, there were 300 grievances in the system in Lordstown. And this is in a plant with over 7,200 workers, so that's a minimal load. The plant was then turned over to the General Motors Assembly Division, who are a rough, tough, cost-cutting outfit. They moved in and, by their own admission, have pulled out at least 300 workers with the same production schedules. By the union's claim, 700 workers. They have imposed new standards without changing a thing. They are disciplining workers. Up to now, the point of discharge, over 600 have been so disciplined, and the workers are fighting back. What may be different is the intensity with which they're fighting back, because they are young and maybe don't have as many hostages to the future. But this is just a plain, simple, old-fashioned struggle over speed up. It is General Motors reaching in and pulling workers out, not by more product because of better ways of doing things, but simply speeding up workers. And I would hope that the management of the General Motors Corporation would do something about it. The General Motors Assembly Division, unfortunately, their personnel people have no authority. That's true at the plant level. That's true at the divisional level. And the corporation people with whom we deal seem singularly unable to discipline the behavior of the General Motors Assembly production people. And the production people decide all the make all the decisions. Personnel has no countervailing authority over them, and I would hope that the new chairman of the board, Mr. Gerstenberg of the General Motors Corporation, would see to it that this very bad situation in Lordstown is brought quickly to an end.
A series of questions now, which I suppose fall in the category of the human side or the ecological side. What is the UAW going to do, or what is it doing to humanize the dehumanizing, debilitating, and boring process of working on an assembly line?
Well, obviously that's a problem. It's not a new problem. What's new is there's more being written about it now, but that's been the problem down through the years. Reflects itself in many ways, the high absentee rates that we have in certain plants. And the reactions of people to it. I was quite interested to read during Christmas week that in Volvo and Saab in Sweden, they're moving towards developing a substitute for the assembly line. However, it's not the main line, it's simply the feeder lines, which lend themselves more to group activity, where a group of workers will finish a product so that they have some feeling of being identified with a completed sub-assembly, at least. This is primarily a problem of the assembly plants. It's not so much a problem of the fabricating plants. It is of some of them, not all of them. How you can find an answer to it that does not have astronomical costs associated with it, very frankly, I don't know. I would believe the best answer is a staggered work week, the shortening of the work week, which I think is now being demanded by virtue of the structural rise in unemployment. And I think with a staggered work week, you could do two things: shorten the working time of the individual, but also lengthen the working time of the capital equipment. Because as the work week is shortened, if it's shortened for the whole group, and you leave that capital equipment idle for an additional day beyond the Saturday and the Sunday, then capital costs get very, very substantial. But a flexible work week, which shortens individual time, lengthens the capital equipment working time, would also serve the function of reducing capital costs, and well could be, I think, the next necessary step in the collective bargaining process, at least in mass industry.
We have had a series of automobile recalls for various defects. Does this mean that on the assembly line, labor has become shoddy, careless, and incompetent?
Well, one of the arguments in Lordstown is that, and this was printed in the New York Times last Sunday, quoting some individuals by name, inspectors who were knocking products down, and the foremen were passing them through anyway. And this has been a part and parcel of that argument there. The speed of the operation has something to do with it. We have a long-standing argument with management that there should be more emphasis put on inspection. There should be more inspectors. The biggest problem, if there has been any sharp deterioration in product over the last several years, has been that a few years ago, the companies sent to the dealers and made the responsibility of the dealers the make-ready work on the car. Make-ready work, which in the past had been done at the factory. And unfortunately, the labor compensation rate paid by the manufacturers to those dealers was less than the rate that they charged their normal customers, which gives us a substantial incentive to sort of bypass that work. And the other thing which contributes to difficulties in a mass product is the almost limitless number of options that there are now in a modern day automobile. And I think, in fact, if you take it on balance, allowing for the proliferation of options and the sophistication of the machine as compared to one of 20 years ago, I'm not sure if it is a fact that the product has really deteriorated as against a past time. And I am quite sure, too, that the European manufacturers, in fact, I know, have exactly the same kinds of problems, the same kinds of problems.
Well, the automobile, the product that your union members make, is considered to be responsible for about 50,000 deaths a year. What can you do about this specifically? What about mass transportation as a means of uncluttering the highways?
Well, our union has long been in support of a development of a mass transit system. We have to have a transportation system in this country. Simply, you know, building more and more freeways will end up with the United States a whole lot of freeways running from one parking lot to another parking lot. And the proliferation of the automobile as the only element in a transportation system is going to be self-defeating. And I was certainly pleased when the Ford Motor Company the other day began to make public noises of their willingness to work towards a mass transit system. And the industry would be serving its own interests if it also began to do some serious planning for the development of a transportation system, which the automobile is one component, but where there has to be mass transit within cities, between cities, and across our country. We're in complete support of that. And by the way, when you worry about the poor cars we make, we also build the DC-8s, DC-9s, and DC-10s.
What is the UAW's position on the postponing for 1 year of the correction of emission from exhaust pipes?
Well, I don't know. We don't have the competence to know. The companies keep telling us we can't do it, we can't do it. And apparently there isn't anybody who does know. I see some stories that say everybody outside Detroit knows, but when you want to know who is everybody outside Detroit, they sort of disappear into mythological creatures. I did propose to the Department of Justice that the companies be allowed to pool their resources, monitored by the government, to see if it was not possible to find the answer. And we got turned down in that regard. Now, very frankly, the public has a right to be skeptical when these companies say we can't do it, because it's less than 10 years ago that they were saying the automobile had nothing to do with the deterioration and degradation of the atmosphere. And so that an industry which was so slow to admit the problem has to be given a good long look when they say we can't meet the problem. I would hope that the research that's being furthered by the government could determine the answer, and maybe that's the way in which it should be pushed. Obviously, we're very much concerned about this, but all we just ask them and they give the answers. We don't know whether the answers are right or wrong or propaganda or fact.
Is Ralph Nader a friend of the UAW?
Well, I think Ralph Nader performed a great service to the American people and to the industry by pushing the question of automobile safety. And we have cooperated with Mr. Nader in various projects. Obviously, we're not always in agreement with things that he says or he does, but by and large, we think he's been a most useful citizen and one that we are happy to be associated with.
Mr. Woodcock, we certainly thank you for your frank and interesting and significant answers to our questions today. And in appreciation of your coming here to be with us, we have a National Press Club certificate and also the traditional gift of a National Press Club tie.
Well, thank you.
And we have one more question for you. You say we need new faces in Congress. Does that mean you want Senator Hart to get a shave?
Well, I see Phil's got to answer a roll call. I think Phil looks kind of neat with the beard. And I think Harold Hughes looks real neat with his beard. Well, Bill Eaton isn't in the Congress. If he would run, maybe we'd support him. But Phil Hart, I have known for a good many years. He's a great human being. He's a man of utmost integrity and a man we certainly have been very, very pleased to support down through the years. I remember when Phil Hart was first running for lieutenant governor, on a Labor Day, I introduced him in Muskegon. I lived then in Grand Rapids, and I'd driven over there with one of my daughters, who then was somewhere around 11, I think. And I gave Phil a big buildup. And she says to me as we're riding back to Grand Rapids, "Daddy, why did Mr. Hart blush when you were introducing him? Maybe that's why he wears the beard. I don't know."
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.